Coming to you direct from the heart of New York City, all the way to wherever you are, you're listening to the VIP Jazz World Report. Ladies and gentlemen, there's a quote that goes a little something like this. It says, "The fool who said less is more never had more." And I guess that's why most of us dream of becoming an entrepreneur in today's world. But really, what is an entrepreneur? How do you become one? What does it take? These questions are going to be posed to my guest, who happens to be one of America's greatest entrepreneurs himself. Bill Wooditch is the founder and owner of a very successful financial company called the Wooditch Group. He's the author of the best-selling book called Always Forward. He's the founder of the entrepreneurial movement called Think Next, Act Now. It's an honor to have on the show the filthy rich, the very wise, and the second most handsome man on this show, the one and only Bill Wooditch. Welcome to the show, Bill.
Vip, I will try to live up to one of the three descriptions.
As long as it's not the third one.
Can't be. Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Oh, you're welcome, sir. Let's start by, you know, defining the word entrepreneur in today's world. Because it seems to be a millennial version of what in the 80s and 90s it used to be, the consultant, the management consultant. You know what I mean? Were you that young at that time?
I've read about that. I've read about that. But I think you're mentioning aptly today's world, because it's been watered down to a point where entrepreneur now is a buzzword in parties, perhaps, or it's the word, it's the what we all want to do. I mean, who wouldn't want to work for themselves? Let's work for ourselves, and let's say we're an entrepreneur. But if you look into the word and look into the stricter definition of the word, you're going to see connotations. You're going to see action words like innovator, and you're going to see risk, and you're going to see a person who creates a market, a person that drives market demand, a person that is out there without that net of security, where they're just risking all personal finance and taking all their fears out there on that rope, and they're making things happen. It's much different than today, and you're looking at people who start a business, and people are assuming I'm an entrepreneur because I started the business.
It sounds like, you know, like soldier of fortune, you know, it's sort of glamorous, you're risking it all and things like that.
It sounds glamorous, yes.
But in order to be an entrepreneur, should one be causing disruption to the status quo?
Not necessarily. And I want to go back to one thing that's very important when we talk about entrepreneur. This is an individual proposition. It will be an individual definition. And I think as individuals, we need to ask ourselves the first question. Why? Why do I want to become an entrepreneur? What is it? How do I define it? Do I define it as an opportunity that others haven't yet realized, or is there an unsatisfied demand, or is there something I can do to improve an existing business? Do I have, you know, that unquenchable self-belief? What is it? And then look into the mirror, that mirror that reflects two things for us. It's got to reflect an internal need, that need either to validate, to prove. It's got to be something more than the monetary. It has to be that internal drive. And I think, Vip, we look in the mirror often and we have denial and delusion. And the first place that exists is of the self. So when we're self-assessing what we want to do and how we want to do it, you know, we confuse that with the money. I want to drive your Ferrari. I want to live at the beach. I want those houses. I want these things. You don't know the price and you don't know the cost and don't know if you're willing to do it. So the first place is in the mirror. What is it that we must have? What is it we're willing to do? And who are we at our core?
Okay. So what's the difference between an entrepreneur and a businessman? I mean, someone who flips real estate, isn't that a businessman?
Well, this is where we might diverge a bit. I think that a person, it could be a mom and pop store, but they've risked all their finances, they put their house on the line, or their ability to make it to the next day depends on them. So there's no security, and that's the key word. You and I might say security, that's ultimately an illusion. Well, they've given up the security of a steady income. So there's no safety net. They either make it or they don't, based on their ability, and their ability must drive market demand, and it creates market share for them, or it does not. That, to me, is still a version of an entrepreneur.
But then I guess all entrepreneurs end up becoming businessmen, right?
I think so. Think of it this way. The buzzword still today is I'm a leader. I'm a leader. Well, a leader presupposes that we have followers. And I think just saying we're a leader doesn't make us a leader. So I think a lot of people who start a business say they are a leader. Mm-hmm. They say they are an owner. Not necessarily. A lot of times the business runs itself with other people, obviously, but it doesn't run through the owner. And a lot of times we're not leading if we don't have the followers. And followers means more than just bodies. It's a whole heart and mind. So do we have to be a disruptor? No. Do we have to be compelled and have a message that's in alignment with us, the messenger? Yes. Do we have to have the resilience to move forward? Yes. Mm-hmm. Will it cause disruption from the naysayers? Yes, because the aggregate will dislike us because we're the ones out there on the cutting edge, the bleeding edge, making things happen. And people don't want to see that because it's risk and people want to be safe.
Why did you want to become an entrepreneur?
Had an internal burn. I had two things. I had a fire behind me. I didn't want to go back. I had this intense pain of imagery of where I came from. When I crawled out of the backwoods of western Pennsylvania, I still can smell, you know, the lacquer and the sawdust in the factory I worked. And I went through this image, this mind-numbing image that this was the rest of my life. And this was all I was going to do was this rote, very basic activity. So I had an opportunity to go to school. Mm-hmm. And I started going forward. And I've always had this, and I think this is very important with entrepreneurs. I have this certain DNA, this certain genetic predisposition, I say, where authority was kind of tough for me to follow, and following rules really wasn't in my DNA. And I always wanted to do and see, you know, create something that was mine, something I could call mine, and I wanted to see how good I was. So, Vip, when I worked for two Fortune 500 companies, I didn't know if they were buying the corporate logo. Mm-hmm. They were buying an amalgam, maybe a combination of me and the logo. But I just had to know. I will ask this of the listeners. When you ask that why, ask these two questions. Do I want to sit on a bench one day with regret and ask why didn't I? Or would I rather make that all-out effort, go all in, mm-hmm. and say I did? So to me, it was easy. I wanted to see how good I really was. That was number one driving force.
Well, in your journey, and you know, you have this entrepreneurial movement, Think Next, Act Now. What are some of the most common misperceptions people have of becoming an entrepreneur? Because it seems, you know, when I talk to a few people and they have this dream, and even if I'm talking to young people, it's always about the end result of the Ferrari, the house with the pool, and, you know, the parties and things like that.
Well, the common misperception, and I speak with probably 6 to 7 potential candidates a week, mm-hmm. so the floodgates are definitely open, and I'm very judicious and very selective in whom I pick, but you never know until they're engaged in the battle. The one thing they think is that people are going to work for them, and that at a certain point they're going to be doing, and at a point very soon, that there's going to be a lot more cash, there's going to be a lot more financial aggrandizement, and they're going to be able to run the show. So they don't know the sacrifice that you're always going to wake up with it, you're always going to go to sleep with it, you're going to take this thing on vacations, you're never going to be free again in that way from the mistress, from the wife, from the husband, that is your business. So they think they can somehow be detached but still be attached just enough to get out there and be famous and make a lot of money and have a yacht.
And that's what I have a problem with, you know, because when they say, oh, I want my own freedom, when you're an entrepreneur, you actually have less freedom than before because you're breathing, living, working with what you're creating. And I think in your book you wrote, you don't own the business owns you.
Yes. The first mindset shift that I had when I started the business, I woke up one day in Australia, got a call from a potential client, and I was still in the throes of jet lag. And I thought, wait a minute, I have to still do the work, which I think is number one. You have to still do the work. And I thought, I don't own this business. It owns me. I have to be involved in this every day. I'll never turn it off for the rest of the time. So in 24 years, I haven't been able to turn it off. If I go on vacations, if I'm waking up from a slumber, I'm thinking about the next move. What have I done? How can I address my downside? So you never go away from it. And I thought, I don't have employees. I am the employee. And once I did that, that little shift, it made me free. I started laughing, and then I got it. I thought, you know, this is the rest of my life as I know it. So you'll have less freedom in that way in terms of if you think you're going to get rid of stress, there's a way to contain it and work through it. But you're never going to be totally liberated to just jump and say, you know what, forget it. Not if you have responsibility socially and morally to people, no.
Well, then, you know, everyone in some way, shape, or form desires to be an entrepreneur because it obviously sounds glamorous. But how can one realize that they have what it takes to be an entrepreneur? That's the key difference, right? That's the key difference between the success and the failure.
Well, I would break down what it takes in general to be an entrepreneur. And I think we have to take the – I will never offer a general prescription for success. I won't offer a general prescription for how to do something. So when people come to me, I'm asking questions, but I'm not really giving answers. I let them find the answer within. So I'll ask the questions. Have you looked at this? What if this happens? Are you responsible? Are you looking only at the possibility but not the responsibility? You know, I can't look into your spouse's eyes and say, assume this risk. I can't do that. That's an individual proposition. But you better have the resilience gene, the ability to get punched and get back up. You better have a strong conviction and belief in yourself, and it can't be a faux one. It has to be real. You've got to have that, because that fire in the message will move people, because people are moved from emotion first. The logic will support the emotion, but they will be moved from that emotion. So you better have that self-belief, and you better have the ability to be flexible and agile, because life will come at you. Things you never expected will hit you. You can almost expect the unexpected. It's coming. So you have to be agile, and the last, and I think the most important thing, you have to have allies. And you have to have advocates. I was able to build quickly a team around me that could support the deficiencies I had. So I knew by looking in the mirror, I couldn't do everything. I knew I had one thing I might be able to do average, but a lot of people could do things exceptionally that I couldn't do, attracted them to my platform, and move forward.
So if I was to ask you, I mean, if the audience is listening and saying, what are the three types of people that I need with me? Who would they be?
Well, first thing is you need the people that can think and do. And there has to be the short of a time distance between your thought, a deliberate thought where you're thinking through all the possibilities that you can possibly know at that time. You have to have an action that follows quickly behind that thought, because someone is thinking and not doing. Someone is doing and not thinking. It's the ones that can think and do with the shorter time lapse that really start making the difference, because they're the first in. They're on the cutting edge. They're the ones that are, as you would call it, disruptor, because the status quo doesn't think, or does think, and is afraid to do. You want the thinker and you want the doer. You want the person that can execute. You want the planner, yes. But there's no strategy, as they say, that's ever overcome the first blow from the conference room, because the client's going to change all that. The customer's going to change your strategy. You better have flexible tacticians and people that can run the numbers, to make sure you know where you are as a control index, because you can't fly blind.
So in real life terms, would you say in any venture that you're entering into, you need to have a good lawyer and a good accountant?
Yes. A very, very strong legal advice, a great accountant, and you have to have people that check all of their work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yes.
You know, in the beginning, you said an interesting thing, that it should not, being an entrepreneur, should the prime motive should not be about making money. And even in the book, you said, you know, you're very clear, this should not be your prime objective, and yeah. It begs the question, why?
Well, the prime objective, if it's money, you're going to get to a point of comfort. Comfort is a death knell for an entrepreneur. It's a death knell for achievement. At a certain point, we all reach that level of, quote, comfort. It just is a matter of how far out we extend that line. So I would look to money and the trappings that money brings. You know, I think that you want to feel the paddle shifts in a brand new Ferrari. If that's all you're chasing when you're making those calls and starting your business and looking for capital and looking to satisfy your shareholders, and that's all you want is that material gain, you'll wear out. You'll wear out, and the illusion of that feel will fade with it. But that internal fire, that need to validate yourself, that need to prove yourself, that need to make a difference just because you can make something new, make it yours, make a difference for another person. And that sounds sappy, but I went into it really thinking. I took 2 months from my last, before I started this company, and I just thought, and I reflected, and I asked a question. Is my client base better off without me in this game, or are they not? And that resounding feel, that internal tug, and that head was calling me forward and said, no, you need to be in this game. And I had a different way of approaching things, a different model, and it's been supported by the client ever since. Internal feel.
A lot of entrepreneurial stories that we hear sound very rosy, and people sometimes fail to see the struggle, the sacrifice. And when they do see the struggle and the sacrifice, it sort of puts them off from actually engaging in their ability to be an entrepreneur. How does one manage the fear? How did you manage fear?
Well, I think fear is the most important part we have to live a life. And let's start with what's important. We're mentioning the term entrepreneur, but this really is about lifestyle options, creating freedom and what's important to you. You know, I like to work backwards. So to me, there were two very important things. And one was the freedom of to do what I wanted to do within the context of constraint from society and from the business landscape. And the other was not to have debt. I really wanted to get rid of my debt load, but it's not the reason I started, because I was in deep debt when I started the company. So I really wanted to move forward, get through that, and I had to move through fear, because fear is different than danger, and I think that's important. You know, danger is a person or thing that can cause harm or injury, but fear is that imagination that plays itself in this great color from the recesses of our imagination forward as a narrative that we read and think, if we do this, this is what it felt like. I don't know if I can do it. So we have to be able to face, deal with that imagination, deal with that insecurity, that resistance that wants to hold us back. The resistance wants to hold us back in that cocoon of illusion, of comfort, where we don't have to risk. Because to risk in the days of our ancestors is to be in peril of the saber-toothed tiger. Well, the saber-toothed tiger of today exists in loss and change. We fear loss, and we sure as heck fear change.
And I love that. You know what? Fear is different from danger. Fear of failure. But I also think that subconsciously some people have fear of success. Because what if it works? It takes them to a new level. And you know, as I've said before, new levels bring new devils. Mm-hmm. How do you prepare yourself for getting to the next level?
Someone once showed me a bell curve. It was a CEO. Showed me a bell curve of what he thought an entrepreneurial-driven company looked like. And it had this childhood that started up on the bell curve, going up, like just picture a line going up where you're an infant, you're crawling, you need to get capital, you're struggling, you're actually doing you're ordering the pencils in addition to developing the strategy. But then you get to the adult where you're able to walk, and so you start to flourish at a certain point, peak in your own bell career. And that's usually a function of your energy level, your enthusiasm, your that burning need to still keep going, and that's where you change. That's where you spark off and do something different within your own entrepreneurial envelope. So when I get to the point where I think, this is where I am, I've been doing this, this is starting to kind of bore me, bang, I'm going to get out and change something else. I developed an internal group of intrapreneurs, people inside here who don't have to risk their capital, but they can use their skill set in their own little companies within my company. So there, I'm kind of scratching their entrepreneurial itch, but they don't have that wire to go across. If they fall, it's like, so it's really worked for me. It's a different design. So I'm changing the design. doing this new entrepreneurial company is a whole departure from something other people think is very successful. Well, yeah, and I'm risking my ego at this stage of my career. It's because it's inside of me. It's inside of me.
But then it doesn't sort of scare you that when you get to the next level, you might not have the ability to manage that level consistently? Let's say your turnover of your company is now, say, let's say, $100 million. And you suddenly, in 6 months' time, you get to $200 million. That requires a different thinking style, a different team effort, possibly a different infrastructure, and you might not be prepared for that. And as a result, that $200 million is only a passing moment, and then you go back to the $100 million.
You've done your homework because you nailed it the first time on the number. But let me tell you what the next number requires, and this is something that I look in the mirror with. It will be someone more capable than me to drive the infrastructure to the next level. Someone with much greater skills as a CEO than I have to get to the first $100 million. You know, getting to that next level requires a different skill set. And if I don't have the capability to learn, grow, acquire quickly, and I'm going to prejudice the company and I really believe in the company, then I'm going to get the heck out of my own way. And that's what I'm doing. So there are different things in the infrastructure, the tough calls that I have to make that will get me out of the way. And I think that going to the next level for me is the entrepreneurial company. There's a bigger devil there than I've ever faced because I don't know it. It's a devil I'm not familiar with. I don't know what's going to come out from behind. You know, it's like that movie Gladiator. You never know what's going to come out from behind these walls. We have to be prepared and fight together to stay together. I don't know what's out there. But I know if I play within myself and I do the very best I can, which is all I can do, is be the best form of me, I'll bring it on. Let's play.
Now, you know, in your world, you're in the business of encouraging people to become an entrepreneur for those who want. But to a certain extent, I guess that's also very risky. Now, if some people were to say to you, can I be an entrepreneur and have a part-time job because I'm trying to mitigate my risk off my uncertain income. Now, you're not a great fan of that, are you?
Not at all. I think no plan B means that you have, if you have no plan B, no option to fall back, there's a lot more of that need to move toward that what we must have and what we've said we must have, we must own, we must move forward from there. I think plan B is already, if you have plan B, that's really going to become your plan A. A default mind mechanism, a way to go back. A way to go back is a way to fail. And I say this from painful, costly experience. I have seen these eyes, these bright blaze of possibility come in and promise the world. And I will always talk people down off that ledge. I'll try to talk people out of it first. This is what it is. This is not what it is. This is what all the unglamorous, break your nails, dirty stuff. This is what it takes. This is the grind. This is the cost. This is where we're going to take this from you. And, you know, they're looking at me and saying, but this is what I'm going to do. I want that. Well, they confuse that for the material and not the it for what they must really have inside. Mm-hmm. And as soon as it gets tough, and it gets tough at about 3 to 6 months. I mean, you see that light fade. You see that vigor dim. They start coming in a little later. They're not coming in at 7 a.m. They're dribbling in here at 8:30. They're leaving at 4, not 6 or 7 or 8. They're not doing the work. They're not putting in the effort. They're falling back, polishing up their resume, and sending it to people in one of their schools or some of their friends where they can actually get a job or something different where they don't have to do that type of work. I don't like plan B. I don't like it.
Not at all.
Well, let's talk about plan B.
Yeah.
In your strategic evolution, in your development of this is what I must have, and all your strategy is going to change when you first get hit. This is going to be crazy. It's going to have to take a different slant sometimes. You're going to have to maybe change strategy. In changing strategy, you could go to a plan B strategy where maybe you take a little different route, but you're still heading to the same island. You're still going to the same destination. Your plan B is, I just might have to take a little slide off over here. So maybe you're finding another way to fund the enterprise. Is there another way to attack? But your plan B must be that. It can't be, okay, that didn't work. 3-6 months, I'm out of money, I'm out of here.
Right.
No, it can't be that.
Talking about going to your destination, you've got a book out called Always Forward. Yeah?
Yes.
And this... Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Always Forward. Where do the words come from? Because you're the sort of guy who has meaning with everything he's saying.
I do. And I think that's not only a rallying cry, it's a way of life, because this is a philosophy of life that has to be lived. And being an entrepreneur, becoming an entrepreneur, becoming someone who spearheads some kind of innovation, who people follow, who you have a great obligation to mentor. What a great obligation, a serious obligation to reshape people's lives that you're influencing in the words you say. Well, the one thing I know, that life does not support a vacuum. It's not going to allow us to sit in this sealed vacuum. It won't. Life is always forward. The next. We have to think next. Act now. We have to be thinking of what is next in our lives. How do we anticipate a threat? How do we take out this next business opportunity? How do we make this ours? What's the downside? How do we move forward? It's not going to be a straight line, but how do we keep moving our value forward? This is life. This is about life options, lifestyle options. This is about having the fun in the game, creating the game, you know, being able to play the game and play it well. That's what this is about, and that's not sitting still. That's not going backward. That's growing.
Now, there are thousands of motivation books out there, and you are, I think, shrewd enough to realize that what's missing in the other books that you are providing?
What's missing?
Yeah, you must. I mean, you wrote this book, so obviously you must have read other books and saying, well, that's great what they're saying, but they've missed out on these key points, and this is how I'm going to fill the marketplace with this because it has additional value.
I took 2 days off and stacked up about, I'd say, 25 to 30 books. I literally stacked them up. Didn't get them on a Kindle, didn't get them on the iPad, just stacked them up. And I said, what's the one thing all these guys talk about? All these people talk about one thing. So I traced it all the way back to Viktor Frankl, Man's Search for Meaning, found Tony Robbins doing it, found all these people talking about attitude, attitude, attitude. So many people are buying off on that word. And that's a catch-all phrase for people to say, but I got a great attitude. So they have all these mantras, all these platitudes, all these sayings that all stapled across their desk, and that's supposed to be their rallying cry forward. You know what? You got to have brains. That's a lot of bravado, and it's someone else's bravado who probably hasn't done it, so they're a consultant on the sidelines. I'm in the game. So what I want to do is be intellectually honest and tell people, I don't know if you can do it, but I will tell you this for sure as hell. Attitude is not the only thing. It's essential. So don't tell me that's an add-on. That's something you have to come equipped with. So what I wanted to be is to be the voice of dissonance, the voice that makes people think, the voice that can give a direction of how, that can also say, here's the way. If you don't have the compelling pull to go forward, and your head says, I want the money, but your gut says, no, I'm afraid, don't go. Don't go forward. You're going to get killed. Don't do it. If you have that gut that says yes and the head that's driving you forward because there's a compelling reason for something bigger than and greater than what you are and you see the possibility of what you can be and become, go. That's the difference. I don't want to tell someone you can do something. I loathe the term motivational speaker. I think people either find me to be a broadcast station for increase because of the way I live my life forward or they don't.
So then if I read and follow your book, what can I hope to become?
The best form of you possible. You can become the best form of you by doing one thing, just taking one challenge. You know, as a writer, you fear leaving the better book in your head. But the question you have to ask is, you want someone to read from the book of life that you are writing every day. Mm-hmm. Every day, every action you take, every thought you have, you're writing the story of your life. So your thoughts and words are going to impact other people. So the time you have, the time is always going by. It's right now. It's in it. It's that inelastic thing we can't get back. You can change the dynamic of your life, and it's not motivational drivel, by taking those always forward steps, the small steps, like an Ethiopian proverb. Eat that elephant one bite at a time. Face your fears. Face the dominant fear. Move through it. Pull it to the light of awareness. See it for what it is. Move past the instinct. Write a story you'd want others to read and learn from. That's the gift you have to give. That's the reason I wrote the book.
And then you just said, you know, see it for what it is. And you have a great section in the book called Visualize to Realize. And a lot of other people have that same philosophy that, you know what, you have to see it. You have to see it. But I get the feeling that people are seeing it, but they're seeing the wrong thing. They keep seeing the Ferrari, the big house, the private jet, and then it's not getting them anywhere. Where are people going wrong? What are they not? What should they be seeing instead?
Well, let's go back to the mirror. Let's go back to visualize to realize. The first thing you have to be able to visualize is to look inside and realize who you are at your core. You have to know yourself. And you have to be able to stay true to yourself. And I think that was Shakespeare. It said, be true, you know thyself was Socrates and then Shakespeare, and be true to yourself. So you have to look in that mirror. And what comes back from that mirror is going to reflect maybe in the dark.
That's the most difficult thing to do.
The most difficult thing.
It is really difficult because it's very hard to sort of self-criticize what you cannot do.
Well, I think that's the part of the ego that needs to be contained, because your ego is going to see things that it wants to see, and it's going to cloak itself in a form that says, this is what I am, this is what I can become, this is what I want to do. So you have to first have what I call honest introspection, if there is such a thing, or get at least as close to that as possible. And you may not really get that until you do something. But the other way you want to visualize and realize is to put yourself, not only just look at a car, but look at meeting with a person. So you first meet with a person, and let's visualize how that relationship will evolve. I just met with you. Let's see. I think of the next step. I think of you laughing. I think of us sharing stories. I think of learning from you. So I'm visualizing all these instances where I'm already with you, and I'm already doing learning positive things from you. That's what I mean by visualize from the external to realize, because I think my mind takes me in the way it confirms and how it thinks and how it perceives, in how I first visualize things to happen before they even happen.
You have an interesting segment in the book based that I haven't seen in other motivational books. It's willpower.
I will say this succinctly. Willpower is the difference maker in life. Willpower is the difference maker.
How is it different from something like perseverance and determination?
Let's be careful with the word perseverance, because perseverance can sometimes be confused for being stubborn. So I think, you know, stubbornness is like, think about banging your head against a wall. The wall's not going to break. Your head will at some point, but the wall won't. So I think you have to feed your body, feed your mind that willpower. We're all born, Vip, with a certain amount of willpower. Some have less than others. Some have a larger amount. You know, think of a ruler. Some are like 6 inches, 2 inches. Some are like you, 14. So we're born with that finite amount, but we can then grow it. It's like a plastic part of our brain, which is a fascinating part about learning about willpower. And we can actually grow it by extending ourselves out further on tasks. Well, we have to use the weapon. We have to use the weapon to our advantage. It doesn't mean awareness means that we're banging our head against the wall, being stubborn. Yes, we're persistent, but boy, our business platform doesn't have any value because no one's buying it. No one's buying us. They're not buying our platform. But yes, I'm almost there. I can almost break through. And no, you're probably just being stubborn. But willpower means you're starting to make inroads. You can see it start to click. I want to keep driving. I have to keep driving forward. How do I have the energy, the conviction to keep moving when you don't want to pick up the phone? You don't want to knock on the door. You don't want to get on that flight. But you get on and you make it. That's the difference in willpower. That's the difference between being aware, stubborn, and having the willpower to hit the goal.
I might sound silly at this point, but it's almost like you need to get in touch with your inner soul and get in touch with your gut instinct, which says you just need to keep carrying on. You're still on the right track. Your objective is right. You're going to get there. It's just getting past these hurdles. It's almost like a practical form of meditation.
Yes. Yes. And I want to further that. It's beautiful. Because there, to me, there are four pillars. there are four pillars. There's the physical part, which means you're feeding your body the proper nutrition to be able to cash the checks your mind writes. Physical. You have to have the spiritual. You have to be in touch with yourself to say there's got to be an overarching, bigger belief in something greater than me at play here, something where I'm actually contributing to the greater whole, that there's something greater than me. And you have to also have the intellectual part, the knowledge, the willingness to be curious. That's one of the ways over fear, is to be curious. So we want to keep growing that curiosity. That's how we learn from the mistakes of others. We don't have to make all those mistakes. We can watch other people step on those nails in the yard. When I was a kid, you know, I used to be my dad was a carpenter, so he had these big long nails, and you run through there, you wouldn't look. Ouch! And the first time you do that, you start looking. So you can tell people there's nails in the grass, and they can kind of learn from that, or they can step on them themselves. But we don't have to take all that pain. We can learn intellectually and emotionally. We have to be able to extend a quality of care, first for ourselves in forgiveness, and then for others in a compassionate way. So we're there as a total a person with all four of our pillars, the intellectual, the emotional, the spiritual, the physical, that houses the most important thing. That's our values. Our values. That's the right and wrong. And our belief system. Now, why are we in this game of life? What are we doing here? If it's to have fun and be engaged and enjoy and contribute, well, let's be the best form of us to do that. So it's not just about driving an entrepreneurial spirit or going behind a platform or proposition because we want to make money. It's about getting out there because it's part of us. It's just a natural evolution of who we are.
And in your book, you've also got a great section on walk away power. What are we walking away? What's the power that we need? What are we using it to walk away from?
I learned this a long time ago. People smell three things on you: fear, desperation, and greed. And sometimes when you're at that table, you're bargaining away the one thing you can't bargain away, the only thing you can give away, and that's self-respect. So you're sitting there thinking you're taking less than a deal, you're taking something less than you really want, you're just staying at the table because you're afraid to lose something. So you can never make money unless you value yourself and your product. So you have to be able to actually walk away. And sometimes you'll see that people vote with their wallets, but they also vote with they also negotiate with their feet. Sometimes they don't leave the table. But when you can walk away, there's almost that rejection quality that happens in relationships where he or she, people aren't going to like this very much, but he or she who cares least generally controls most. And it's the same with negotiation. They can smell that on you.
Beautifully said. Beautifully said. Here's the thing. You're saying people can smell three things on you: fear, desperation, and greed. Yes. Aren't those the three most common feelings every entrepreneur will go through in the very beginning?
Well, you're really going to go through fear.
Yeah, because you've got put everything at risk, right?
Yes, everything's at risk.
And desperation, because you want to make it work.
Yes. And some of the biggest setbacks I've had is because I lurched quickly, very desperate, very, very much the need to be compelling. So I lurched out there and tried to make things happen instead of working a normal process. The cologne, if we're going to stay with the stench of greed, desperation, and fear, the cologne is confident competence. It's being confident in what you have, in the value of what you're selling or what you're enrolling, and the value that you bring to the table. That brings a confidence that people feel. They feel that on you, and then they open themselves up to the competence that follows. That's the whole style and substance. You have to have substance. But boy, that confident style, that way, that demeanor is what people feel. And I had to learn that by getting my ass kicked doing it the other way. And I did it for a long time that way.
And you had a beautiful saying, actually, in one of your other shows. Style gets you in the room, but substance will keep you there.
Yes. I think that I found this to be true in the diverse landscape that is the company that owns me. Remember, I didn't say it, that I own it. I found that some people here are extremely extremely, extremely capable with numbers, extremely, and they can send down a logical persuasion and put the numbers to back and support whatever they want you to buy. And eventually, people are going to look to them for the emotional side. Where's the connection? Okay, we bought this, but we want you to be a person. And other people are so gregarious, so emotional, so driven by that shake of hands and serotonin release that follows, that the numbers are almost secondary. But eventually, the numbers have to follow. So I think you have to have one or the other. But first of all, to me, and I think for most people, style to me means the essence of who you are, the way you enter a room, the demeanor, the way you capture a room, your positivity. It's just a feel. It's just your presence. I think that is the first thing that gets you in the room, because people buy from emotion first. It's instinct. And then they want to see. They want to feel the logic. You know, they want to know that you care about them before they ever care about what you know.
And when numbers don't work, ultimately, I mean, it's reality. Some things fail. Some entrepreneurs are going to fail. A lot do, actually. What's your advice? You know, we all say don't give up, persevere, have fortitude. But in reality, when should one pull out? No pun intended.
You know, sometimes we're around the dinner table, and we're with a group of CEOs, and we're all talking with that bravado, and maybe we had a little bit of elixir of nectar of the gods, and we all sound like it was just a really easy jump here. We just followed Winston Churchill, we took this thing by the neck or somewhere else, and we just made things happen for ourselves, and so we have to be careful that we don't poison young minds with, this is how we did it, you know, just go out and do it. Teddy Roosevelt said it's the guy in the ring that gets the credit. Yeah, we got to be careful with that stuff, because we can get killed with that. I think that failure is going to manifest itself not in the form of rejection, but in the form of utter rejection. In this way, people aren't just going to buy from you. It's going to be a proposition that's failed, and you have to know when to cut your losses. You can't keep throwing bad money after good. That's going to be your ego saying, I don't want to be known as a failure. I don't want to be known as someone that came up short and quit. So I'm going to keep going until I have to wash dishes and keep doing it. Well, that's noble, but it's probably not the smartest thing to do.
So that means mentally, I mean emotionally, having all those, the desire and the ability to continue against resistance, but in your mind, you really need to be so-called level-headed.
Yes.
And see reality for what it is and see beyond that too, right?
Well, you're mentioning two things, and it's very difficult to reconcile intellect with emotion sometimes.
Yes.
You know, we have to be able to come up to the level of awareness. So you're talking about being level-headed, but you're emotionally invested in something. And that's where the blinders come on with people. That's where the blinders come on. So they've made that emotional investment. And they, you know, let's just, yeah, I know, but it's going to happen. So they rationalize their decisions to get out of that. I think a lot of times, and even in marriage, people are saying, I want this. I don't want to be alone. I want kids. I want. So it's a bunch of I's that don't really equate to a we-based proposition. Mm-hmm. And that's a lot different platform. And I think it's the same with an entrepreneur. You're going a lot of I's. I want the car. I want the house. I want this. Well, you know, are you willing to pay the price? And you won't know what it is until you're actually invested in it. And sometimes the cost is too much. You got the wrong program. You got the wrong portfolio. You got the wrong product. And maybe you're the wrong person to do it.
Now, in your experience, I mean, give us a practical experience in terms of you've mentored quite a few entrepreneurs. Can you give us an example that worked?
Yes.
And then I'm going to ask you about one that didn't. And why? Why did one work and why didn't the other?
There's never been one that I've vetted. And I have vetted, I could probably pull the number at some point, but it would astound you probably. But there's never been one that I vetted that I didn't believe, because the most gullible, credible person is a salesman. All right? So that I didn't believe that in our system, under my wings of tutelage, that they wouldn't be better. There's not one that I didn't think could change the world for themselves. And see, I have this thing inside of me. I want to see people take it and make it. I get a bigger kick. That's my legacy. I want to see them take it and make it, not because it's mine, not because I didn't give them anything. All we can give people as leaders, now let's go leaders, is a fertile environment from which to seize and create opportunity. We can't hand them an opportunity. We can't. What does it look like? It's the environment. So I remember coming back, and we huge account we had just closed, and I was with a producer who was really, really making some tremendous progress. And I looked at him, and I said, you know what I think? I think the great ones are driven by skeletons of the past. I think they're driven by a need to validate to parents, either living or dead, or themselves. But I think that those ghosts of the past are what really drive people like you forward. And I can almost see a tear in his eye on the way up. And I think that deep need, that to see I can make this, I have to show someone, I have to show myself, that's been the big driver. The ones that have failed have come in looking like the Wolf of Wall Street, and they went out like the Lamb on Main Street. So they came in dressed up, puffed up, they're going to kick ass and take names, and they're going to change. They wanted an office. They wanted my office today, which they could have right now, but they wanted my office today. And those people convinced you, convinced me, they're going to make it. And you know what? They didn't. And I think that I can't tell you what to risk. I'm not looking in your spouse's eyes. I'm not looking in their eyes. I can't tell you what is responsible and how to balance your responsibilities. And I listened to one of your podcasts. You said balance responsibilities with possibilities. That's a great way to look at risk, because I'm not in your home front. I had nothing to lose. Nothing to lose. There was only four. It was just me. But there weren't other people pulling on me that I had to look at every night and say, am I making it or not? Now, that's a lot of pressure. That's a lot of pressure. I didn't have that. So the ones that make it come in. They have that forward need. Mm-hmm. They burn their boats, metaphorically speaking, and there is only forward, and they really have a burning desire. Maybe they failed somewhere else, and this is it. But the ones that haven't, they have a plan B, and that's why I loathe that plan B. They got another way out. They'll still dress in a suit, they'll do something else, and they'll still tell themselves, you know, that they're the second coming.
You motivate others.
I do.
Who or you inspire others. Who motivates and inspires you when you fail, when you get maybe a pang of fear? How do you come out of it?
I come out of it by reading. I come out of it by reading and having a discourse in my mind with some thinkers. And I look at people who I had one client.
What do you read, by the way?
By thinkers and people I read about.
Which books do you read?
Oh, I'll read books. I'll jump all the way back and pick up a little bit of wisdom from maybe Alan Watts. You know, he'll talk a little bit about spirituality, and then I'll dive into William James, and I'll go a little bit about psychology, and then I'll clear my mind, and I'll read something that's maybe current. But most of the stuff I read is nonfiction. I like to learn. I like to learn something I can apply. So I always want to move forward with something that I can take away and apply. And when I did my book, I read about 78, I think, 76 to 78 books just on fear. Mm-hmm. I learned what I was really afraid of. It's a good thing I learned it then instead of before. I probably would have never moved. But I learned all about fear. But I will tell you this, though. I think always about a client I had who survived Auschwitz.
Right.
And he was actually in line. So he was 1, 2, 3, 4, and four doesn't make it. And he still had the tattoo on his hand. And he came from there to become a major, major developer and builder with $1 billion of empire from Auschwitz. And I always thought, man, when we think it's tough, when we think this stuff's hard, that's perspective context. That's the type of positive mentorship. I look for people that can come through the crap, people that can get their butt kicked and get back up and give, people that can learn from the fight and bring it on. That's where I'm learning. That's where I learn from. Yeah.
Bill, we've almost come to the end of the show. Time has really flown. You are poetic, sir, in the way you explain stuff. I have to give you that. And very meaningful. It's been great having you on the show. Where can we get the book?
You can get the book from Amazon at amazon.com, and you can check it out there, or from Bill Wooditch. That's one word, Bill, WOODITCH.com. BillWooditch.com. Amazon.com or BarnesandNobles.com.
That's great. Thank you so much, Bill.
Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening. Your comments and your followers so very welcome on my Twitter account at Vip Jaswal and my Facebook page. Just type in Vip Jaswal Report. A special shout out of thanks to my wonderful team, William Sanchez and Rick Buser. I'll be back next Sunday at 6 p.m. Eastern. Until then, I wish you a wonderful evening tonight with your loved ones. And until next Sunday, have a productive and a very happy week ahead.